A very good afternoon to you, Namibia, and a warm welcome to On the Radio News Analysis right here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. I'm your host, Ndafa Happy Juju, and I shall be keeping you company from now up until 14:30. Now, of course, today is Wednesday, the 24th of September, 2025, and the time is 3 minutes past the hour of 1300 hours. And with the week now in full swing, Namibians are busy shaping the stories of the day. Now, whether you're tuning in from the vibrant streets of Walvis Bay, heading to a shift in Roodrits, managing livestock near Opuwo, or following along from a university library in Ongwediva, thank you for making Eagle FM your station of choice this afternoon. And as always, on the Radio News Analysis, it's where we take a deeper step closer into the news. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask why it matters, how it touches the lives of ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future, from big policy decisions to the small details of daily life. We unpack the forces shaping our nation and bring the voices that matter most. And don't forget, your voice is just as important as the headlines. Share your thoughts with us on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, WhatsApp, and listen to us and tell a friend to listen to us via the Eagle FM app or Eagle FM website. Now, from the energy of Arundo to the quiet evenings of Otapi, from Mariental's farmlands to the riverbanks of Kurunkuru, wherever you are this Wednesday, we are glad to have you with us. This is On the Radio News Analysis, Namibia's stories unpacked and connected to the people who live them. Let's get right in today's top stories. Namibia's journey toward a modern, inclusive and secure digital payment system will depend heavily on financial inclusion, digital literacy and collaboration. Minister of Information and Communication Technology, Emma Theophilus, has said she was speaking at the inaugural Payments Through Thought Leadership event hosted by the Bank of Namibia, also known as BON. Theophilus underscored that the success of the country's digital payments transformation rests on ensuring that no Namibian is left behind as the economy becomes increasingly digitalized. Now, digital payments cannot thrive in a society where people lack access to financial services or the skills to use them effectively, she said. Financial inclusion and digital literacy must therefore go hand in hand with innovation. The minister also called for stronger public-private partnerships, stressing that government regulators, financial institutions, and the technology sector must work together to expand access, reduce costs, and create safe digital ecosystems. She further highlighted the importance of risk management frameworks to build trust, protect consumers, and ensure the stability of Namibia's financial system. Now, the event, which brought together regulators, banking executives, fintech innovators, and policymakers, comes at a pivotal moment for Namibia. Like many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Namibia is experiencing a rapid shift toward mobile money and digital payment solution, accelerated by smartphone penetration and changing consumer habits. Yet challenges such as high data costs, rural connectivity gaps, and limited consumer awareness continue to slow progress. Now, for the Bank of Namibia, the Payment Thought Leadership Series is designed to create a platform for dialogue on the future of payments, exploring opportunities in fintech innovation, across broader payment, cybersecurity, and financial regulation. Theophilus' remarks align with Namibia's broader digital transformation agenda, which seeks to position the country as a regional leader in digital finance and technology-driven economic growth. Experts at the event noted that if Namibia succeeds in combining innovation with inclusion, it could significantly boost a small business growth, strengthen consumer protection, and unlock new pathways for job creation. Also speaking at the event is the Deputy Governor of the Bank of Namibia, Dione Dunn. Let's take a listen to her speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, our national payment system, as we all know, it's not merely a machinery of transactions. It is the very backbone of economic growth, of financial stability and overall trust in our economy. Its modernization is not a single once-off event. It is an ongoing journey of reform, innovation and adaptation to the shifting realities of our time. Around the world, payment systems are ever-evolving at an unprecedented pace. Simultaneously in Namibia, this reality also comes home, and we are advancing with the same speed, with the necessary clarity and vision as well as intent. However, the picture is not as rosy as what I just spoke about. Our financial inclusion surveys reflect a journey of good progress overall, but also serves as a stark reminder of unfinished work that we need to deal with. In 2007, less than half of Namibians, around 49%, had access to financial services. By 2011, that number had rose to 69%, and by 2017, it reached 78%. Now, many may say 78% is quite a good number. Why are you stressing? But if we pierce through the veil of progress, we will see that the national progress, in that national progress, lies a sobering reality. The benefits of this progress remains unevenly distributed. While urban inclusion remains relatively high, rural areas and the informal economy, less than a quarter of adults within the rural economy and the informal economy remain excluded from formal financial systems. These are not abstract numbers that the bank came up with. These numbers reflect untapped households, untapped farmers, traders and workers completely left at the margins of economic life. And to leave them behind and continuously excluding them would be the greatest cost of all. Our national payment systems must therefore act as a bridge which connects available as well as new and innovative financial services and products to those unserved and underserved segments of rural Namibia and the informal economy. This bridge must extend opportunity to every Namibian, no matter where they find themselves and regardless of what type of telecommunication device they hold in their hands. And it must ensure that no one is denied the opportunity to access available as well as new and inclusive financial products and services. That is our call to action. The Bank of Namibia's fast payment solution under its instant payments project, driven by its Instant Payments Namibia subsidiary, remains steadfast in its resolve to serve as that bridge, bridging the divide between the current excluded and underserved, enabling them the opportunity to fully participate in the economy. Our instant payment solution bridge, allow me to call it that, it weaves together rural and urban communities into a whole new financial fabric. That is why, as we continue to modernize, our duty is not only to align with international standards, but to ensure that our home-based realities are effectively addressed and making sure that every Namibian enjoys access to the type of financial services I spoke about earlier. That access should be secure, it should be very, very affordable, it should be trusted, and it should open the door to state-of-the-art innovations that reflect the dynamism of our changing economy. We need to future-proof our national payment system and infrastructure, and welcome all new payment providers. Leaving them on the margin is calling for arrogance and ignorance. In the age of mobile apps, platform-based companies can truly overlay existing commercial networks with payment services. We are seeing examples in other countries where this has fueled the meteoric rise of electronic and mobile money. Customer expectations are also changing. Whether hailing a taxi or having lunch, today's consumers want things instantaneously. Their expectations for an instantaneous needs met are the same as far as payments are concerned. The payments infrastructure must therefore keep up and keep pace with and meet consumer expectations, offering value-added services that enhance the overall consumer experience. The gratification must be immediately, otherwise the payment service and product miss the point. Payments are often silent, and I think most of the time we take them for granted. It moves beneath the surface of daily life. It remains invisible, yet it is indispensable to the economy. Every purchase, every salary transfer, every cross-border trade rests on a system that must be able to be trusted, which settles unequivocally, instantly, and in a resilient manner. At the Bank of Namibia, we know and we understand that national payment system is not just a technical rail. It is the digital bridge, connecting buyer to seller, employer to employee, and citizen to the state, as well as Namibia to the world. And without that bridge, economies fragment, and with it, prosperity indeed flows. Ladies and gentlemen, if we reflect over the past two decades, Namibia's national payment system has undergone remarkable transformation. Once characterized by paper-based transactions and limited access, it has evolved into a more digital, interoperable, and competitive ecosystem that now underpins every facet of economic life. The phasing out of checks as a payment instrument, the ongoing modernization efforts in the existing payment streams, the issuance of our open banking and QR code standards, the migration to ISO 22, and the pending go live of our instant payment solution, overall ensuring e-money interoperability, are all testimony of this progress we have made. Through deliberate regulatory reforms, such as the promulgation of the Payment Systems Management Act 2023, the revised determination on the issuance of electronic money, PSD3, and the determination on the operational and cybersecurity standards within the national payment systems, we truly work tirelessly to ensure an enabling regulatory ecosystem, embedding transparency, security, and consumer protection at the core of the system. These achievements were underpinned by the National Payment System Vision and Strategy 21-2025. This vision facilitated structural reforms, broadened participation, and led to enhancements in payment infrastructure, cybersecurity standards, and stakeholder coordination. Equally significant has been the shift in consumer payment behavior. Namibians are steadily adopting digital platforms, preferring convenience, speed, and security in their daily transactions. This was also further accelerated by the COVID-19 pandemic, proving that digitalization is not an add-on, but that it is foundational to a modern ecosystems around payments meeting the consumer needs effectively. We must also be very honest today about persistent challenges, lessons, and dependencies that exist and that need our collaborative action. As we engage in this strategic thought leadership, we must reflect on what is happening globally. What can we learn from others, but equally understand our own challenges to enable us to position Namibia's national payment system as a world-class ecosystem that supports an increasingly digitized economy. The Cambridge SupTech Lab under the School of Alternative Finance 3 weeks ago did a brilliant presentation guiding us that we are facing a whole new financial system architecture where we will see AI-enabled actors, AI-enabled product services. What does that disruption mean for what we currently know as our payment system infrastructure? Do we understand it properly? Are we positioning and gearing ourselves effectively to deal with that not even future change, already existing, happening change. And are we optimally positioning our national payment system infrastructure to deal with this new financial system architecture? Those are the critical questions that we need to ask today to make sure our financial system is ready today to gear with it already happening future music.
And there you had it from Leonie Dunn. She is the Deputy Governor at the Bank of Namibia. You are tuned into On the Radar News Analysis right here on Eagle FM. We pause right here now. Take a trip to the marketplace, but we'll be back with yet more news to interrogate. Stay tuned.
Lipura nenge no wapungwa eva tero uliko ni mando tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweko dite okoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshefa ili nehola mo iho etike ko vano hile ko shuwana konongeshefa ya pungwa kukaraya ko vano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okupitira oipindi konu kwanda doi inawa minuto otukwetira o special amge kashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumuna oijamweli nawa inge Pada Fanona, Monica, Co, Eagle FM, Honora Tatime, Bali Heavy, Nola Natu, Heavy Bali No Hair, Ileko, Erewa, Hora Hetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Hatatu, Oma Lane, Eagle FM, the Eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura, and I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. The Forum of German-speaking Namibians has called on both the private sector and government to take urgent steps to improve Namibia's ability to attract investment across underdeveloped sectors of the economy. Joining us to discuss this further now is our reporter and journalist, Dwight Links. Good afternoon, Dwight.
How are you doing, Happy?
I'm well, thank you. Dwight, kindly educate us about this. You wrote about it in the Villager e-paper, that is Monday's edition, Wednesday's edition, on the Forum of Germany-speaking Namibians, calling on Namibian government to improve Namibia's ability to attract investment across other sectors.
Well, the particular discussion, Happy, obviously just for the listeners that have not read the edition for today, just to let them know, obviously, that this discussion took place this past weekend, meaning this past Saturday, and was based more as, in terms of if for the particular conversation that was taking place there, there were two presentations from two economists present there, as well as also presentations from the public sector, and also at this, obviously, the host of the particular conversation, that being the forum themselves, giving their particular insights. But all in all, it was more like a clarion call in terms of citing both that public and private sectors of Namibia have to come together to achieve some sort of an elevated or an improved ease of business or ease of doing business platform or status of Namibia. Now, Happy, I know the next question you'll obviously ask me is, what is ease of business? Mm-hmm. And this is a particular ranking that exists in the World Bank itself. It's a ranking that helps any particular prospective investor or entity or organization or whoever they might be, or even a government, to try and understand, what do we look like in someone else's eyes or in someone else's view. Now, it's got obviously weights and mechanisms that help it try to, establish what the weighting is. For example, they use a system that takes an aggregate, meaning it's a total score on 10 particular topics, and each of these consists of several factors. and then they give a weight to each of these topics. So Namibia on that list, the list, it puts Namibia at 100 position, 104. So you can obviously see it puts us, obviously it puts us low-ish. I say low-ish, because they rate things like how do you start a business, being able to start a business, how high is that, weight, dealing with construction permits, for example. I'll cite to you that in Namibian context, you know, there's only two particular local authorities or three. No? Let me rather say just two, regions that technically can talk extensively about how many building permits building permits that includes renovations as well have been approved, which gives an insight to you in terms of, you know, how much activity is anticipated within the construction sector itself. Getting electricity is another weight that they apply. And then there's the registration of property. So property can obviously be, you know, the aspects in terms of registering a business and all those other particular kinds of weights. So that helps people to get an understanding in terms of, you know, what are all these particular scenarios? Because you also have other weights and other mechanisms applied to this, like getting credit. So credit is technically loans, protecting minority investors. So these are investors bringing, you know, various kinds of investments to Namibia. This can be into fixed, into assets or into items like a factory or equipment, or it could be an investor just bringing money. Now, this can be both a local and an international or external investor. Then there's an aspect in terms of paying taxes and another one in terms of, you know, trading across borders, you know, Namibia's relationship with its immediate neighbors or established trade partners. And finally, enforcement of contracts and the resolving of insolvency. Now, the last one specifically about the resolving of insolvency is specifically a profound statement, Happy, because that specific indication of resolving of insolvency is when an investor, local or external, sees that, you know what, the Namibian market is just not doing it for me. I'll probably have to close down shop and I'll probably have to release people, meaning retrench or let go.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the heart of the particular conversation that took place on Saturday, specifically in the scenario, is that the presenters, and some of them cited specifically, there is a warped idea in terms of how Namibians look at the economy, as opposed to the actual picture that Namibians should have of the economy.
Okay.
I'll let you bring in another question before I continue.
Thank you, Dwight. Now, kindly tell us about Namibia being ranked by the World Bank Group's assessment 104th globally. And, yeah, what actually criteria did they use for this?
Well, I just outlined them now to you, Happy. Specifically, you know, you're looking at the ability to start a business, of the ability of dealing with construction permits, the ability of getting electricity, registering a property, getting credit, protecting a minority investor, paying taxes, trading across borders, enforcing contracts, and resolving insolvency. So all of these are the weights that are used against the, you know, in terms of measuring a country's particular ease of doing business internationally and even locally.
Yeah.
Because firstly, obviously, in the theory of, you know, of business development or market development, is that you've got to create your own local markets first before you start inviting international investors or external investors.
Okay.
You can ask.
Okay, cool. Now that, Dwight, based on your research, I know that you do a lot of research on a lot of things. The forum stressed that while Namibia has generated global interest in its emerging oil, gas, and green hydrogen sectors, of course, the country must also ensure that the broader regulatory reforms and infrastructure development are prioritized. Now, based on your studies, Dwight, in your own capacity as you do, what do you think is the danger in this, in prioritizing particular sectors and letting others kind of like pull along?
Well, the danger specifically, if I answer the danger question, is that Namibia has long been known for its 35-year independence for not being able to diversify its economy, Happy. It's been something that many Namibians would have been taught about even on high school, they would have been taught about the various sectors that you need to have that need to help with economic development in your country, meaning you start from agriculture and mining. Those are your bedrocks. Then you move to the semi-processing, which is your secondary phase. For example, we're looking at more smelting and more refinement, if you can call it installations. These can be factories or these can be, what do they call them? Sort of like plants, processing plants.
Mm-hmm.
You take that to another level to say, the tertiary level is now making a consumer good, adding more value to the semi-processed item. So we're saying a piece of iron ore taken out of the ground at a mining site is then transported to a smelting facility or processing plant, which adds a little bit more value. It cleans the product a little bit, adds one or two aspects to it to make it steel. That steel, which is now in its semi-processed form, because you can't just use steel as it is right there, that steel would then be bought by let's say a manufacturing plant that makes, let's say it's steel beams for the construction industry. They then buy that steel to process the steel and make more value to the steel. They then supply it and sell it to their distributors or to retailers or direct buying agents who buy on behalf of the final customers and consumers. So that is literally the trend I illustrate to you, Happy, that is a very weak particular diversity or diversification strategy in Namibia's economic landscape. Because many or any economist will tell you Namibia has to diversify. Namibia's particular dependency on announcing every year at the budgetary announcements
mm-hmm.
that the diamond sales have performed poorly. Well, gee, I mean, come on. You know, why are we announcing diamond sales as if it's something important for any Namibian to make use of? I know I'm trying my best, Happy, not to involve my own particular viewpoint of diamond sales, because in the finality of things, Happy, you and I, we can't do anything with a diamond. We really cannot do anything with a diamond in Namibia. We can't even own it. Yes, we can own it, but we should have bought it, you know, which at an exorbitant price, and obviously through an established, like a supply chain and value chain and distribution setup.
Yeah.
The other thing is also, Happy, that we've got the other particular sector that is very fragile in its existence, and it needs actually more support from diversification strategies, aggressive ones, in the other particular developments like the secondary and tertiary sectors of Namibia, is that the services sector, which Namibia has a lot of Namibians employed in, actually needs a bedrock of customers, consumers coming through from other sectors that need to buy and use and sell and make the money circulate in terms of buying services and goods from the service sector. So service sector, we're talking about banking. We're talking about hospitality and tourism. We're talking about sports even. You're talking about us media as well, because we're literally doing a service as well. We're talking about, there's another one, the retail sector as well, which technically is a slash between service and the physical goods being dispensed and offered. So we've got vulnerabilities all over the place. At the heart of these particular vulnerabilities, Happy, is a scenario in terms of how best does our economic developmental plan cascade downwards to the everyday person, meaning you, the individual, and it cascades back upwards to give a positive reflection, i.e. an aggregate picture saying, hey, listen, Namibia did something about its unemployment figures. Or, hey, listen, Namibia did something about its particular service provision discussion, and there's this aggressive rollout plan regarding building more schools in for more Namibians that will need more school facilities. I had that discussion yesterday with Anakleta, where Anakleta gave me a description of, you know, the wider issues around that Ndama school setting.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the view that you see is you see the view of the children sitting on logs outside being taught in a makeshift structure, but you can see past the needs that the children have. You can see past them to see what are the needs that they come from, that they bring along from home. The needs also exist at home. The needs just don't show up at the school.
True, yeah.
they exist at home as well. So what are the issues there for the parents of those kids? Are the teachers paid a salary who are teaching these children? And she shared that specifically the teachers are voluntary. These are people that walk 5 to 6 kilometers from Rundu to come to Ndama, to that where that Ndama school is, to come and teach for free.
And then,
which is literally,
And what surprises you is that, of course, even though the government then would be looking into it, it's as if it's not, talks are not on the table to prioritize them. They have been there at the forefront, you know, when the struggles were there. So I think if the benefits come, then they should be first prioritized. Not necessarily, let's go and do the drawing board and start all over with a recruitment process. Let's first prioritize those that have been there from the beginning.
But here's the thing first, Happy. Specifically, this is not a school owned by the government. This is
it's now legalized.
It takes another particular dimension. This is a school created by the community members, meaning the concerned parents.
Yeah.
The parents realize, you know what, they're trying to generate a particular value proposition for their children, which is a future generation.
Mm.
The thing that I would have loved to have heard in that discussion is that the parents probably negotiated with these volunteer teachers and say, listen, let's collect money as a collective. We pay you guys a salary. That school becomes then a business entity, clearly not for profit, but for meeting the needs that are there to help the children get education. Now, when I said that statement just now, Happy, obviously a lot of people would probably jump out from somewhere or jump, you know, sit upright saying, hey, listen, according to Namibia's constitution, education is supposed to be free. There is a caveat. Unfortunately, water and electricity does not come for free. Unfortunately, transport does not come for free. Unfortunately, food a human needs energy to function. Those children will like to have access to some sort of a meal a day scenario. The voluntary teachers would like to be compensated for their efforts and times, because we're talking about things like pens and papers, which don't come for free. A chalkboard doesn't come for free. Even the, if I can say, even those logs that the kids were sitting on, and that's the makeshift structure, they didn't come for free.
Mm-hmm.
Someone's effort was applied to bring those logs there.
You're right, don't.
So the ultimate scenario, obviously, is that in Namibia, coming through from the forum on German-speaking Namibians, the message that they actually wanted to communicate through that engagement of academia, thinkers in the Namibian economy, private sector, as well as also private individuals and the public sector, because there were agencies and SOEs and ministries of the government in attendance, virtually and in person, is that specifically they have to find common ground in terms of improving the conducivity of the Namibian economy for investors, local and internationally, to actually see Namibia as a desired destination, and not as an afterthought. Oh my goodness, the Ukraine conflict popped up.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, Donald Trump is being weird and saying funny stuff across the world. Now I need to find a safe country. They're literally saying Namibia, even though it has got a stable democracy, stable governance, stable laws, stable societies, Namibia still fares a little bit off in terms of fixing the things that determine economic prosperity.
Yeah.
And those are the smaller details that we'll have to tinker with. I'm not saying that a law should be passed or anything. Usually it sometimes means some sort of a policy needs to be developed.
Mm-hmm.
But the discussion is literally, how do we actually come together to improve this conducivity scenario?
Making sense right there, Dwight. Thank you so much for breaking that down. I sure hope that our listeners have quite very well understood it.
Not a problem.
Cool. Confirming Namibia's ranking, FDN chairperson Harold Hatch said the country must urgently address structural bottlenecks if it is to create an attractive investment environment. And I quote, government needs to improve the quality of the enabling environment and fully embrace the economic growth potential in oil and gas, green hydrogen, and other mineral sectors. Hatch said he noted that many of these energy sources and resources have only been explored in the last 3 to 4 years, representing Namibia with unprecedented opportunities to maximize returns. Now, the discussions concluded with a call for closer collaboration between government and the private sector to ensure Namibia becomes a competitive and investor-friendly economy capable of sustaining inclusive growth. Now, that being said, let's pause right here and we'll be back with yet other news to interrogate. Stay tuned.
Lipura nenge lo wapungwa eva tere uliko ni maundu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kutite okoye ekukulile oshafafa na nongeshefa ili unehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshuwana konongeshefa ya pumbo kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka okupitira oipindi konu honda doi inawa minuto otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushenjife nawa nokumuna oijabweli nawa ninge Fata Fanona, Monica, Ko, Eagle FM, Onora Tatime, Bali Heavy, Nola Natu, Heavy Bali No Heavy, Ineko Lewa, Mura Hetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Batatu, Oma Filane, Eagle FM, the Eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. The Namibia University of Science and Technology, NUST, has broken new ground this week as it hosts the country's first ever Cancer Genomics Conference, a three-day gathering that promises to put Namibia at the center of global discussions on cancer research and treatment innovation. Now, the event, which runs from the 24th to the 26th of September 2025 at the Hilton Hotel in Windhoek, is being organized in partnership with the International Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology. It comes at a time when cancer, the second leading cause of death worldwide, is increasingly emerging as a major public health crisis in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, under the theme, Harnessing Functional Genomics in Cancer Research, Opportunities for Diagnosis and Treatment, the conference will spotlight the role of genomics, the study of genes and their functions in transforming cancer diagnosis, treatment, and outcomes across Africa. The program is set to feature keynote lectures, scientific sessions, and hand-on workshop with a specific pre-conference that already took place and was dedicated to early cancer career scientists. Let's now take a listen to NUST Vice Chancellor, that is Prof. Erod Namab.
Today, to the inaugural Cancer Genomics Conference here in Namibia, as the Vice Chancellor of the Namibia University of Science and Technology, I'm deeply honored to stand before you at this distinguished gathering of scientists, academics, healthcare professionals, and policymakers united to confront a formidable adversary, cancer. We at NUST are humbled to serve as a main co-sponsor and host of this groundbreaking conference in partnership with the International Center for Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology, the Ministry of Health and Social Services, and our colleagues across Africa and the globe. Together, we are laying the foundations for a genomic revolution in cancer research, diagnosis, and treatment. This conference represents a critical milestone for Namibia on the path to advancing cancer research, enhancing biomedical innovation, and ultimately improving health outcomes for our people. Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to extend our heartfelt appreciation to every participant who has traveled far and wide to contribute their expertise and commitment to this cause. This cause is indeed justified from my opening remarks. At NAST, we recognize that cutting-edge research is vital for breakthroughs in cancer, the understanding, the diagnosis, and the treatment thereof. We have invested significantly in genomics, bioinformatics, molecular biology, and the multidisciplinary teams focusing on cancer genetics and molecular foundations through our Department of Biology, Chemistry, and Physics. And I want to take this opportunity to just ask the colleagues from the Department of Biology, Chemistry, and Physics to stand, including the executive dean, so that you can see who they are and you get a chance to interact with them. Please rise, my fellow colleagues. There they are. Yeah. Thank you. When the prepared speeches, sometimes you just in hindsight think about things, right? Now, the investment that is being referred here is that as a university, we are taking very bold and drastic steps, as I talked about at the beginning, to say democratization of healthcare, precision healthcare, is not a privilege. It's something that we feel is our deep commitment as a university. So we have invested a little bit to acquire the next sequencing, Illumina sequencing machine, which is quite expensive, I know. But we know that the operational cost has come down significantly, as I have highlighted, from 100 million US to about 500. So that means that once we have capitalized the department, the operational cost falls within the budget of the department. We are also pleased to inform you that we house the supercomputers, high-performance supercomputers that will now be linked to the sequencing machine that will help further collaborations within the continent of Africa, but also across the world, so that we are able to work together and increase the representation of the African genomes in the global data. So that is the investment that we have made. Ladies and gentlemen, led by Prof. Lamek Wapanka, who is the Associate Professor of Medical Biochemistry and the Program Coordinator of the PhD in Natural and Applied Sciences, our Cancer Genomics Research Group pioneers studies identifying genetic cancer biomarkers unique to Namibian population, examining how genetics and environmental influence cancer risk and progression. I must just say something here. We are a country that is known to be very diverse in our culture. And it will be quite interesting to know from a diversity perspective. If you look at the indigenous communities of our country, the San, the Obahimbas, and so on, when you eventually go down to their genomes, and you check mine against them, will you be able to prepare the same type of precision medicine for me and for them? Or will it be different? It is quite an interesting topic, which I hope will also be explored to see whether the answer to some of the lifestyle diseases, but also with respect to cancer, maybe the answer lies in the genome of the original inhabitants of this country. Maybe some people are more susceptible to certain markers and others are not. And if you are able to determine why some people are less susceptible, you may be able to find the solution on how to develop the markers for early detection and also for treatment. Do I sound like a scientist? Okay. I'm sorry. I'm going to conclude. One of the greatest benefits of this Cancer Genomics Conference is the platform. It offers our yearly career scientists to learn from leading experts, access cutting-edge research, and build networks that will shape their professional journey. As an institution, we are proud to nurture this next generation through targeted programs, research initiatives, and partnerships that equip them with the skills and confidence to drive cancer genomics and advance the health agenda of our continent and the globe. By investing in our human capital, we are building not only sustainability, but also independence in cancer research and clinical excellence. In doing so, we empower Namibia to take ownership of its health agenda and to lead with confidence in shaping solutions for our people. Director of Ceremonies, precision medicine based on genomic insight holds unprecedented promise for transforming cancer treatment by tailoring therapies to individuals' unique genetic profiles and tumor characteristics. By leveraging our advances in cancer genomics, we envision integrating precision medicine into clinical practice, offering patients more effective personalized treatment options that improve survival and quality of life. Ladies and gentlemen, science cannot thrive without sustainable funding. At NEST, we know that advancing career cancer genomics requires not only strong infrastructure, but also collaboration across disciplines and sectors. As sponsors of this conference, we reaffirm our commitment to mobilize resources, leverage funding, and advocate for greater investment in cancer research and innovation. We call on our international collaborators and partners to join us, particularly in areas such as bioinformatics and proteomics training, so that Namibia can build the critical skills needed to achieve excellence in cancer research and precision medicine. In conclusion, NAS is honored to be at the forefront of this endeavor in supporting research, nurturing talent, and fostering partnerships to overcome cancer through genomics and precision medicine. We extend our heartfelt appreciation to all the delegates, sponsors, organizers, and partners who've made this conference a reality, and to those who continue to dedicate themselves to cancer prevention, care, and research. Thank you so much.
And joining us in studio now to speak about this conference and the first ever of its kind in Namibia is Dr. Lina Iyambo, clinical oncologist. Good afternoon, doctor. It's a pleasure to have you with us on the Radio News Analysis.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, tell us about this groundbreaking event, Namibia's first ever cancer genomics conference. What was the aim of it, since it's still ongoing? What is the aim of it? And just what impact do you think it will have on Namibia's landscape in terms of cancer? And yeah.
So basically, it's a genomic conference organized by the Namibian University of Science and Technology. It's about trying to personalize medicine. Practicing precision medicine is now the way to go, standard of care, if we can say that. As we know, cancer is a very disease that is quite different, and its treatment needs to be personalized according to an individual and according to what genetics a specific cancer has. So the aim of this conference is actually to form collaborations between the stakeholders involved in cancer care, that's academic institutions, Ministry of Health and Social Services, private and non-governmental organization. As we know, genetic is not a cheap practice. It's quite expensive, so it needs collaboration for everyone who is involved in cancer care to take part and see how they can assist. One of the main thing is for academic institution to also showcase what they have and that what we can use as government for those of us who are working in clinical practice, so that we know when to approach them, how can they assist us in patient care and all that.
Okay. Doctor, I understand that it is bringing together experts in of course, in cancer, experts in genetic engineering and biotechnology. Just what is your takeaway from this conference? I mean, of course, I know we're always in a learning mood. What is it that you have taken away that opened up your understanding more deeper as a clinical oncologist?
Already just looking at the topics that have been presented today, one's knowledge is being enhanced in the sense that there are experts from all over the world who have got experience in this area of medicine. It's quite new to Namibia. I can tell you that we don't do any genetic testing in Namibia. So having people from all over the world who are presenting and showcasing how things are done, it's quite mind-opening. It's eye-opening, and most importantly, the fact that it's giving information, especially to our policy makers, for them to know that the medicine has moved to another level. It's not just conventional chemotherapy that we used to give to our cancer patients.
Yeah.
They are better treatment methods that has got good outcomes and fewer side effects, because we know mostly what our patients are scared of in cancer is the side effects that comes with our treatment. So it's quite eye-opening, both to the policymakers, to us as clinicians, and to the student community, because the conference is attended by quite a number of students also who are in research. And they have opportunity to network and form collaborations with this international organization, be in the area of funding, area of advancing their careers and everything.
Mm-hmm. Now, Doctor, I know that you're one of the speakers at the conference. What was your speech all about? What is it that you focused on? Maybe give us a bit of a summary on it.
My talk was, actually I just finished talking, so my talk was on where we are as a country when it comes to genetic or molecular testing, what we can do and where we can be, and most importantly, how we can collaborate with stakeholders, be it locally or internationally, in order to bring about this field of genetic in the country. Obviously, starting somewhere, even Rome wasn't built in a day, but
that's
we
true.
Have to start somewhere.
That's so true. And what is it that you expect from us as a public when it comes to conferences like this? Somebody listening at home, perhaps at the village in Oshikuku, what is it that you expect from us when we're talking about advancing and also educating ourselves in terms of cancer awareness?
Yes, awareness. We can never overemphasize when it comes to awareness. Sharing of information, the media plays the greatest role in sharing of information, educating the nation, making our patient understand the importance of this new area. Like one of the questions I was asked is how we are going to make sure that patients are involved, especially in research. You know, all this negativity towards any new thing coming up in medicine. So as media, you have to be our partners always to make sure that this information is going out to the public, the right information in that matter. And then, the aim should be understood that whatever we are doing is really to just enhance the health of the nation. And cancer is killing us with our small population of 3 million. And the number of cases that we are getting every year on an annual basis, we need to really pull up our socks when it comes to cancer care. And we can't do it alone if the public is not coming on board and collaborate and work together with us.
And if the public is not well educated. But Doctor, you know that Eagle FM's doors are always open to educate the public. So knock on our doors anytime.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. Dr. Laina, thank you so much for making time for us right here on the Reader News Analysis.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay.
Bye.
Mm-hmm. And then you had it from Dr. Lina Iyambo. She is the clinical, she's a clinical oncologist. And of course, she's just educating us on what transpired at today's conference at Hilton Hotel. Now, of course, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. When we do return, we shall be bringing you what's making headlines in terms of economic indicators.
Lipurane ngelo wapungwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno mweku tete okoye ekukulile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshiwana onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otona ebi toda njuka okupitira oipindi konu kwa ndadoli inawa mine uto otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarude dayo loka otone ushendi fenawa lokumuna oijabweli nawa ninge Pada Fanona, Monica Co. Eagle FM, Conora Satime, Bali Heavy, Nola Natu, Heavy Bali No Heavy, Ileco, Erewa, Brahetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Batatu, Oma Filane, Eagle FM, Nipai.
And should you be interested in marketing with Eagle FM or the Villager newspaper, make sure that you do reach out to our marketing and sales officer at, that is Monica at 083-288-400. And I repeat that, that is 083-288-400. Make sure that your company, your business, whatsoever event that it is that you're perhaps hosting gets the visibility it needs with us right here on Eagle FM. And we have so many platforms that you can actually advertise with us. We have LinkedIn, we have Instagram, as well as Eagle FM Namibia on Facebook, The Villager newspaper out every Monday, Wednesday and Friday, as well as right here on air. That's the number that you ought to call. And of course, now we tell you what's making headlines in terms of economic indicators. Now today, one US dollar is equals to 17 Namibian dollar and 31 cents, and £1 sterling is equals to 23 Namibian dollar and 30 cents. One Swiss franc, on the other hand, is equals to 21 Namibian dollar and 79 cents. And 1 euro is equals to 20 Namibian dollar and 35 cents. One Botswana pula is equals to 1 Namibian dollar and 30 cents. And now for trading economics. The volume of mortgage applications in the U.S. rose by 0.6%, and that is from the previous week in the period ending September in 19th, holding the near 30% surge from the prior period, which was the second highest weekly reading since interest rates crashed in March of 2020. Now, that is according to data from the Mortgage Bankers Association. The results was consistent with another drop in benchmark mortgage rates, now at a one-year low, as a wave of pessimistic labor market data drove yields on long-dated treasury securities to plunge. Now, application volumes for a contract to refinance a mortgage, which is more sensitive to short-term changes in interest rates, inched 1% higher following the 60% surge in the previous week. In 10 applications for a mortgage to purchase a new home were flat. Italy's 10-year government bond yielded near 3.58%, approaching its highest level since early September, as investors remained cautious following Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's recent comments. Now, Powell highlighted the two-way risk facing the U.S. economy, with signs of a weakening labor on the U.S. personal consumption expenditure, that is PCE price index, due Friday, which could significantly influence global interest rate expectation. Now, domestically, Italy is scheduled to sell up to 8.75 billion euros of a 5-year and a 10-year government bonds later this week. On the geopolitical front, NATO warned Russia it will use all necessary tools to defend itself, while Trump said Ukraine could reclaim all Russian-occupied territory. The Philippine government budget deficit widened to ₱84.8 billion in the August 2025. That is from ₱54.2 billion in the same month last year. Government revenues grew 11.4% year on year to ₱352.5 billion, as sustained growth in tax revenues at 3.4%. offset a drop in non-tax collections at minus 67.8%. Meanwhile, government expenditures fell by 0.7% year on year to 437.3 billion year to date through August. The cumulative deficit increased to 869.2 billion. Gasoline futures in the U.S. were at $2 per barrel, rebounding after testing the 5-month low of $1.95 touched on September 22nd, tracking the rebound for crude oil as market recognized the magnitude of oversupply for global energy commodities. U.S. President Donald Trump called for the EU to ban the purchase of Russian oil and gas shortly after Brussels proposed more sanctions against tankers carrying Russian crude oil and fuel. Now, this added to lower availability in key regions as Ukrainian strikes in Russian fuel refineries drove Russian gas sales to hit a 2-year low. Still, the outlook of muted fuel demand prevented a significant rebound for gasoline futures. Seasonal summer travel in the U.S. waned toward the end of September, and anti-evolution policies in China dampened manufacturing activity. Consequently, cracked spreads on U.S. gasoline futures against Brent crude oil were close to their lowest since March. And that's what we had for you today in terms of trading economics. Let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. When we do return, we'll be telling you what's making headline in terms of news beyond the borders. Now, should you want to partake, contribute, ask questions right here on the Reader News Analysis, 083-288-401 is the number in studio. And I repeat that slowly, 083-288-401 is the number in studio.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by
to
setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
The Oshafa fana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana. Onongeshefa ya kumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi toda njuka. Okupitira oipindi konu honda doi inawa. Minuto otukwetira o special angi. Tashake ngeshefa omarudi kayo loka. Okone ushendi finawa lokumona oijabweli inawa. Ninge pata fanona monika ko Eagle FM. Onore tatime bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa, berane tatu natu, bari ofe tatu batatu, oma filane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now for news beyond the borders. We're starting off in South Africa, which is Heritage Day in South Africa, which the South Africans say is crucial in maintaining cultural diversity, fostering a sense of identity. And on this day, they are remembering Shaka Zulu. Let's take a listen.
24 September was previously known in South Africa as Shaka Day, a historic celebration of Umkhosi Welembe's currently being held at Wadugusa. Ingonyama Musizuluka Zwelithini is due to preside over those celebrations. SABC News reporter Mlondi Khademe joins us live with the very latest. Mlondi, when we spoke a bit earlier, the wreath-laying ceremony had just concluded with the main event now due to start. Where exactly in the program are we?
Thank you very much, Mfundo. We are still at the grave site, unfortunately, but the event is starting on the other side. We'll have to drive there. But Mfundo, before we leave here, I wanted the viewers at home to hear from Mxolisi Dlamuka, the CEO of KwaZulu-Natal AMAFA, who they're taking care of the heritage sites in the province. Mxolisi, thank you very much for your time. Briefly about the AMAFA, the purpose of this heritage site.
Thank you. AMAFA is a provincial Heritage Resources Authority responsible for all intangible and tangible heritage in KwaZulu-Natal. So this site is one of our prime sites in the province. This is where the king, the founder of the Zulu kingdom, King Shaka Senza Ngakhona, lie buried. And next, just behind myself, is the actual burial site where he was planted in 1828. And on my left-hand side, it is a memorial that was built by King Solomon Katini Zulu to honor the founder of the Zulu kingdom. Thank you.
So we also understand that this is a provincial heritage site. When are we seeing this heritage site being the national heritage site?
Yes, this is currently a provincial heritage site. We call it Grade 2 site. And AMAFA Council has already approved that this site be regarded as a national heritage site. We are going to be approaching the national body, the South African Heritage Resources Agency, which where we're going to be submitting an application for this site to be declared a national heritage site. We are of the, of the view that given the significance of this site, because King Shaka was not only an important figure in this province, but is an important figure in the entire Southern African region. If you go to Malawi, Zambia, and any other provinces, any other countries in the SADC region, you will find people who are speaking isiZulu. They are there because of what was happening during the 1820s. So King Shaka is not just a provincial figure, but he is, in fact, a figure of national significance.
How many heritage sites do we have in the province of KwaZulu-Natal?
KwaZulu-Natal has 4 World Heritage Sites, 7 National Heritage Sites, and over 200 provincial heritage sites that we are managing. And we're calling upon all South Africans to visit our province, because if you want to understand who the Zulus are, this is one of the most infamous nation in the country. So if you want to understand the history of this nation, come to KwaZulu-Natal, and these heritage sites are well preserved and maintained by us.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time.
Thank you so much.
Mfundo, that was Mxolisi Dlamuka, the CEO. I'll just ask Ubaba.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa is in New York to address the UN General Assembly, and he spoke about that they want the world to buy from them. Let's take a listen.
Continue, of course, to bring
The commerce and trade that should ensue. And to that end, we want the Africa Growth Opportunity Act to continue, AGOA, and also the tariffs that President Trump is seeking to levy on us and has already started to be reduced. And that AGOA treaty should continue. And we are now involved in negotiations with the United States Trade Representative to see the extent to which we can reduce that. And we've also been insisting that the trade between South Africa and the U.S. is mutually beneficial. It's not a one-way trade process. U.S. workers are also employed by companies that trade with South Africa, and similarly, we are also having workers who are employed by U.S. companies. So the two hands in African tradition should continue washing each other, and that is what we hope will continue to happen. Sorry for boring you.
So, Mr. President, let's continue about the domestic situation in South Africa. And you are now the head of a government of national unity.
Yes.
For the first time since the founding of modern South Africa, the ANC didn't win an outright majority. I'm curious whether what are the pros and cons of heading a government of national unity and dealing with those issues of corruption, of the tariffs, state capture, load shedding, all of those things are very, very difficult issues. Is it making it harder or easier?
Well, many things in South Africa are a big challenge, but there are also many things that are really exciting because they give rise to great opportunities to pick ourselves up from where we are to a much better plane. And the ANC, the party I lead, lost its majority, and largely for two reasons, because our former president broke away and formed his own party, and he has a great following in one of the provinces. So that reduced our majority, and he had his own gripes, and it was largely also the person who led the government during the state capture era. And when he exited and formed his own party, many people voted for him, and he won a sizable vote. The second reason was the performance of our economy. Our economy has not been performing at a high level. In fact, we've been having 1% or 1.5% growth, and the rate of unemployment is quite high, and the revenue collections of our fiscus have been sort of tapering down, and not enough financial capability to finance the developmental needs of our country. And inevitably, people do become despondent, and many people did not come out to vote. I don't know what your experience is here in the U.S. So all those things contributed to our loss of the majority vote. We were then compelled to seek partners that we could work with. And we remembered very well what Nelson Mandela led us in and taught us, that it is possible to work with your opponents and even your enemies to advance the interests of the country. But when we lost power, we were the first as the ANC to say we have lost power and we respect the will of the people. And in doing so, we are going to be open to working with other parties, even those that were our opponents. We humbled ourselves to our people, and in the end, we formed, if you like, a coalition with 9 other parties. So we've got a 10-party unity government with one of the major opposition parties having joined the Democratic Alliance, and a number of other smaller parties. So when we formed the Government of National Unity, we remembered what Nelson Mandela also formed when he became president. We had Government of National Unity then, where we worked with our erstwhile enemies, party that had instituted apartheid and led to the killing of many people, exile of many, and the imprisonment of Mandela. We decided that we should work with them to build the nation and to bind the nation together.
Well, we're going to Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's gross domestic product is projected to hit $52.3 billion this year.
With Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube revising growth projections to 6.6% this year, up from 6%. The Finance Minister also projected the country's gross domestic product to climb up $52.3 billion. And Professor Ncube told delegates at the Zimbabwe Economic Development Conference in Bulawayo that agriculture, that mining, and especially manufacturing are driving the recovery that's supported by the stability of the ZIG currency.
Finance Minister Professor Mthuli Ncube says Zimbabwe's economy is bouncing back from last year's drought-induced slowdown, with growth now projected at 6.6%, up from 6% earlier forecast. GDP is expected to climb from $45.7 billion in 2024 to about $52.3 billion this year.
I repeat, the economic growth for 2025 has been upgraded to 6.6%. So by year end, the expected nominal GDP size will be approximately 52.3 $5.3 billion.
He told stakeholders at the Zimbabwe Economic Development Conference ZECON 2025 in Bulawayo that key sectors such as agriculture, mining and manufacturing are showing resilience, with manufacturing outperforming expectations on the back of value addition and industrial revitalization. Another highlight was macroeconomic stability, with Minister Ncube pointing to progress since the introduction of Zimbabwe's gold-backed currency. With the reforms and investments ongoing, the minister says the drive toward Vision 2030 to build an inclusive and empowered upper-middle-income society remains firmly on track.
In line with our commitment to foster a more enabling business climate, government is undertaking a comprehensive exercise to reduce the cost of doing business and enhance competitiveness. This includes systematically cutting down some of the levies, fees, and charges across all sectors.
This year's ZECON themed macroeconomic and sectoral policies for broad-based economic transformation explored issues of de-dollarization, informal sector growth, digitalization and artificial intelligence, diaspora investment, regional integration, and infrastructure development. Authorities believe outcomes from these discussions will help shape the National Development Strategy 2 and inform the 2026 national budget.
The last session on infrastructure development will yield actionable insights and concrete policy recommendations that are vital to steering Zimbabwe towards a prosperous and empowered upper middle income society by 2030.
Meanwhile, Ugandan researchers have developed an anti-tick vaccine.
The Ryonga Dairy Farm in Uganda's western city of Mbarara has existed for generations. The family started off with the traditional long-horned Ankole cattle before moving on to the exotic breed to produce more milk. The herd now numbers in hundreds.
There was a presidential initiative of enriching homesteads and making sure that every family has milk, ensuring production and productivity. So now we incorporated, we brought in the Frisian cows, the hybrid cows. We started to cross them way back in the 90s. Now we reached at a level where we have a very good Frisian cross.
The cows graze freely, but this puts the herd at risk of tick infestation. Ticks thrive in wet conditions and are more active in grassy environments and can cause serious diseases and even death of the animal. The Ryongas use chemicals for spraying their animals, which scientists say are harmful to humans and the environment.
We have a very big challenge. These are Frisian cows. These are not local cows. Their immunity is a bit low compared to our local long-horned Ankole cows. That is why most farmers have now been forced to cross them with the Boran, with the Ankole. We face a very big challenge of disease. Our drugs are still substandard and very expensive at the same time.
Now, a new vaccine produced by scientists from the National Agriculture Research Organization will help farmers like the Ryongas to manage their livestock in a tick-free environment. The new vaccine is an affordable and sustainable way of controlling ticks in cattle compared to chemicals that require farmers to spray at least twice a week. This vaccine is applied only after every 6 months.
Work on the vaccine started in 2005 and is now in its final approval stages before commercial production later this year. The drug was developed from proteins found in indigenous ticks and is said to be over 80% effective.
It is going to reduce the dependency on chemical acaricide for control of ticks, which have proved to be less effective for having been used for several years.
The anti-tick vaccine will be sold at about $1.50 per dose, much lower than what's charged for a similar dose of the chemical products. Eliminating ticks
will not only keep livestock healthy, but also improve milk production and livelihoods of millions of farmers across the country. Isabel Nakiria, CGTN Kampala, Uganda.
The Rhino Conservation Strategy government gets a boost of $40 billion as a goal.
Chief Director of Uganda Wildlife Authority emphasized the importance of the 10-year Rhino Conservation Strategy.
Over the 10-year period where we are implementing the Rhino Conservation Strategy, we are looking for $11 million over a 10-year period. And this is a very good beginning. We've started $140,000, and more money is coming because the campaign is not stopping today. So we expect to make more money, to collect more money, and we've started work on the ground already. We are working on the intelligence fence. We are building ranger posts. We are working on the water reticulation so that the animals, the rhinos, once introduced, they will be able to find a conducive environment.
The government leaders also highlighted the campaign's role in shaping the country's economic future.
Biodiversity, which is the interconnectedness of all forms of life on our planet, is in jeopardy in light of the new global agreement to protect our lands, ocean and waters, because the humans and animals depend on them. Let us all accept that without biological diversity, there is no other life on earth. It is therefore based on that reason that we should rise to the occasion and raise funds for the multiplication and conservation of rhinos today.
The Uganda Tourism Board echoed these sentiments, stressing that safeguarding rhinos is vital to sustaining growth in the tourism.
So this is one in many steps we're taking. I've been saying over and over again, it's about product diversification, product proliferation. One of the products we have is wildlife, but we cannot promote what we don't have, and we're running out of wildlife. Our stock is under threat. Our animals are under threat, whether it's because of human-wildlife conflict, whether it's because of climate change. Either way, we have a crisis that we need to deal with in order to make Uganda a sustainable tourism destination.
With new calves, renewed funding, and a long-term strategy, Uganda is positioning itself as a global sanctuary for rhinos, securing both wildlife heritage and economic opportunity for decades to come.
Meanwhile, analysts say that Nigeria's 50 basis points rate cut is quite bold.
I still have my guest with me in studio here, Bismarck Rewale, the CEO of Financial Derivatives, and Nnamdi Wizu, the co-managing partner at Commercial Partners. Quite a lot to address here, Bismarck. Let's talk about the decision made today. Quite a lot of adjustments made here, but let me get your take, your initial take.
I think it's quite aggressive and bold, right? So 50 basis points is anticipating that the U.S. will cut again before the next meeting. So if the U.S. cuts again, that's another 25. So the asymmetry between U.S. interest rates and inflation will come into bear. Secondly, it was very clear in his mind that he's watching liquidity. Oh. He's watching the stability of the banking system. And also that the recapitalization of the banks is not even a subject of discretion anymore. It's going to be done.
Oh.
So generally speaking, I think it was a good meeting. The decisions were aggressive, and we thought that we'll do something less and then more later. But since the numbers came up, the GDP numbers, inflation numbers, so it gave them enough confidence to do what they had to do, and I think that was good.
Only you called this one 50 basis points, like you rightly did, but the other key thing that came out here is that focus on the public sector, you know, liquidity management in the public sector. And let me get your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, what they said was non-TSA, so the first thing is what would qualify as non-TSA. Typically, it would be FAC, and then I think also NMPC funds. I know they used to have a lot of funds with the banks.
Yes.
But I also know that, sorry?
Yeah.
Yeah, I also know that quite a lot of that has been taken out of the system over the last couple of years by government/central banks. A lot of NMPC funds were actually withdrawn from the system. So I think focus might just be FAC. We always had that cycle where every month you have liquidity coming in from FAC. You know, there have been some theories around, well, why don't you give them dollars instead? And then when they want the naira, they should go and exchange the naira with the bank. So you don't have additional naira liquidity coming to the system. So I guess this is almost a way of sort of trying to sterilize it. It would be interesting to see how they implement. We know that they were subject to the 50% CRR before. Well, now that they said special, then it means that you might have a different special administration. So possibility you debit from source before the money comes into the system. So only 25% hits the system. But what that also means is that if the state governments do spend the funds, right, because it means they will still be credited to the bank, then they would have to refund that money back into the system. The dynamics will change. A lot of state governments we know take all these facilities ahead of FAC. You have some who have ISPOs that are already been issued based on that money's funds coming in. So it'll be interesting to see the dynamics, how it will play out, but definitely a way to sort of sterilize that constant monthly info that comes in, and the central bank has to issue OMO bills to take out liquidity month in, month out. So I guess they're looking for another way to sort of sterilize it without having to pay so much for it.
So, of course, we were talking about that just before we started the show, and let's get into that, because still liquidity is still the topic here. This time, not the private, not the public sector, we're coming to the banks now. You talked about that excess build-up in liquidity in the banks. Please, Mark, your take on that as well.
No, I think what the governor's saying is trying to delink liquidity from inflation, because they mopped up a lot of liquidity, and therefore it is not the mopping up of liquidity that has led to the reduction in inflation. It's more the exchange rate that appreciated, and also the reduction in the price of PMS. Those two items are more potent for bringing down inflation rather than liquidity, because liquidity is not income. So I think he's trying to segregate that, and people have said that if the central bank, if the banks are not recycling the money, then there will be no economic activity. So what they have done is to bring the CRR down from 50 to 45, let that of merchant banks where they are, and also begin to say, let us delink liquidity in the banking system from consumer price inflation.
But for you, though, still on UBS Bank, what would you say was the key signaling ahead of the next meeting, from the meeting today?
Key signaling for the next meeting is that we are going to keep our eyes on the exchange rate and the gross external reserves. If we see any movement, any negative movement, then we would intervene. We don't have to wait for another meeting. We will intervene. I think that's the message I got. But I keep our eyes are open to ensure that nothing goes awry. Okay.
Namdi as well, key message for you.
Yeah, I think basically the same thing. I agree. You'll have to keep an eye on, you know, what happens over the next couple of months before the next meeting. If you ask me, I would expect maybe another symbolic cut at the next meeting. Well, a lot depends on, you know, the impact they see from what they've just done, because it's quite a bit aggressive, right? And I mean, people will say it's a bit overdue once again. You know, earlier I've said, look at what they've done in other African countries, Ghana, Egypt and co. It's about time we also started to try and, you know, tweak it. And I'm sure Central Bank also will be looking at what the effect on inflation, high interest rate, because high interest rate also has an impact on inflation. So at a point in time, they themselves have to start saying, look, rates have, things are normalized, exchange rates seem stable, naira is appreciating. Now what impact, you know, or what contribution does high interest rates have to inflation? And is it time to also start looking at the way to moderate that, to also reduce that inflationary impact that you would get from high interest rate environment?
Yeah, because quite a lot played out there today. This Mark, your assessment was as well on the adjustment on the spending corridor.
I don't think that's too much of a problem, right? But the real thing is that normally when you reduce interest rates, your currency weakens. So 50 basis points means that, technically speaking, the currency will weaken. Will it weaken to a point where it will actually destabilize the rate of accretion of the reserves? No, we'll see that over the next 2 to 3 weeks. If the exchange rate, the parallel market rate, begins to depreciate because there's excess liquidity coming to the system.
Ryan Tim Roth has been found guilty of trying to assassinate Donald Trump in 2024.
Ryan Ruth, the man accused of attempting to assassinate Donald Trump last year, was found guilty of all charges on Tuesday. A jury found that the 59-year-old intended to kill Trump, who was then a former president and the Republican presidential nominee. According to media reports, Ruth appeared to try to stab himself in the neck with a pen after the verdict was read, but he was stopped by authorities.
Justice was served.
Trump, who was targeted in two separate assassination attempts in 2024, reacted to the verdict while at the United Nations in New York.
You can't let things like that happen. Nothing to do with me, but a president or even a person. You can't allow that to happen.
On September 15th of last year, Ruth was arrested after aiming a rifle from the fence line through bushes as Trump golfed at his private club in West Palm Beach, Florida. According to witness testimony in the case, Ruth fled without firing a shot after a U.S. Secret Service agent patrolling the course ahead of Trump spotted Ruth and the rifle and opened fire. Ruth, who had pleaded not guilty to all charges, opted to fire his lawyers and defend himself at trial. Prosecutors allege that Ruth arrived in South Florida about a month before the incident, staying at a truck stop and tracking Trump's movements and schedule. Ruth allegedly carried 6 cell phones and used fake names to conceal his identity. He faces a maximum sentence of life in prison.
Spain counts the cost of nightmare wildfire summer.
This summer has seen a devastating spate of wildfires across many areas of Europe. And while the worst fires have been extinguished, the affected areas now have to deal with the damage caused. The country that suffered the most this summer in terms of land burned is Spain, Guy Hedgeco reports from there on the economic impact of the wildfires.
The worst summer of wildfires in 3 decades. Nearly 1% of Spain's total surface area was burned in just a few weeks. Here, in the rural province of Zamora, the impact has been devastating. Now, those affected are gauging the damage. José Antonio Bruña, a local beekeeper, was relatively lucky. The fire stopped just meters short of his 1,500 beehives. But the burned fields nearby mean his bees now lack much of the flora they need to survive. And because his beehives were not destroyed, he's not able to claim insurance.
Estimo que sobre el 50% de merma de producción. Creo que voy a tardar
mínimo. I estimate that my honey production for this year has been halved. And I think it's going to take another 2 years for the flora that my bees need to grow back again.
Tourism, which represents 13% of national GDP, has been severely affected by the wildfires. This lake, which is a major attraction for visitors, was closed down as the fires approached in the middle of last month.
In agosto, esta zona turísticamente está.
In August, this area was at full capacity in terms of tourism and people who have second homes here. And then, on August 18th, it dropped down to 10%.
Since we arrived here at this lake, a new fire has started behind us. And nearly all the major fires here in Spain this summer have been in the vast, sparsely populated rural areas of the country, like here in the northwest. People who live in these areas have long complained of an abandonment on the part of the central and local authorities, which they say has had huge economic repercussions.
Although the summer has ended, the fires continue, albeit smaller ones, like here in the farming town of Castromil.
It's hard enough as it is to survive because of the price of animal feed and fuel. Every day it's more difficult for farmers to get by. And then, on top of that, this happens.
One farmer we spoke to has had to put down 11 cows which were badly burned recently. A farmer's.
And with that, we have now come to the conclusion after this episode of On the Radar News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onkonana Dingi program brought to you by Loise Shimi. From Indafa Happy Juju, it is goodbye.